Hola, hola, bienvenidos otra vez a Acá Entre Nos. Me van a disculpar, ando bien enferma, pero pues aquí estamos. Mi nombre es Kelsey y pues vamos a empezar.
Ok, yo soy Dawn Marie y hoy vamos a discutir los impactos de salud mental de la migración y, en este país y la vida inmigrante en este país.
Sí. Y como en el último episodio, hoy tenemos visitantes con nosotras otra vez. We have some guests with us today. Sabina González, Grisanti Valencia, and Luis Ojeda. Después de la discusión, nuestros visitantes compartirán un poco sobre su vida en relación con la inmigración y la salud mental. Estamos muy excited de tenerlos aquí. All right, guys, so why don't you start by introducing yourselves?
Okay, I can start. Hello, hola compañeros, compañeras. Mi nombre es Grisanti Valencia, una oaxaqueña zapoteca de los Valles Centrales. Vivo en Fresno y la salud mental es algo que valoro y es importante para mí.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Grisanti. Hi, Luis. My name's Sabina, and I'm originally from Tijuana, right on the border, dirty and funky and messy. And no, the border, not me.
Oh, thanks for the clarification.
I'm perfect. I'm not confused. Sorry, I'm perfect. It's the border that's messy. So I came to the United States when I was 14. To Fresno, unfortunately, and I've been here pretty much ever since. Had two children here, one long-ass marriage here, and here I am. Luis, take it away.
Awesome, yeah. And my name is Luis Ojeda. Also live here in Fresno, but originally from Colima, Mexico, and also excited to be here.
Awesome, guys. Thank you so much for joining us today. We are excited to have you here. Por empezar, nos gustaría platicar un poco de los temas comunes que involucran a nuestra comunidad de inmigrantes. We can all discuss and you guys can chime in on your thoughts and experiences. ¿Listos?
Yeah, thank you all three of you for taking time out of your busy days to meet with us and talk with us about this very important topic, the intersections of mental health and immigration. So our first topic we're going to speak to is immigrants serving this country in the U.S. forces. And ironically, today is 9/11. That's what I say. Pues hoy es el 17 años del 9/11. Well, ni sabía. The honoring of this day is triggering for me. As we know, it's been estimated that over 100,000 have served, 100,000 immigrants specifically have served in the U.S. forces, and only a small few have received citizenship from this sacrifice. And there are currently exist several limitations for non-citizens seeking advances within the U.S. military. For example, federal law requires that all military officers have U.S. citizenship. This means that non-citizens can only join military as enlisted members. Additionally, federal law does not allow granting of security clearance to non-citizens, which limits high-level job opportunities for non-citizens in the force. That said, I verbally like to honor immigrants who have lost their lives during 9/11 and other tours serving the U.S. and who have helped rebuild the infrastructure of our country. So we want to open it up to Kelsey, you as well, and our guests, if you have any thoughts, comments that you want to speak about this particular topic.
So about mental health as it relates to immigrants serving in the military,
yeah,
or
whatever you have to offer.
I mean, I guess to start off really, really broad, to start the story off real broad, I feel like immigrants, and I don't know if we're talking about documented or undocumented, but just generally immigrants serving in the armed forces is kind of such a illustrative example of how we're expected to prove our Americanness
in so many ways and how much pressure that puts on people. Not on me, obviously, because I could care less about proving how American I am. But for the most part, immigrants who come here, you know, we're, our families are like desperately looking for ways to prove how American they are and desperately looking to be accepted and assimilated into this, you know, whatever this is that we are in. And I think the people serving in the military is like just such an interesting combination of a pathway into American identity, like a pathway into being accepted as an American, as well as an act of desperation because many poor people just have no other option for a stable income than to go into the armed forces, right? And it's like, we're good enough to die for America, but who knows if we're good enough to be considered American.
Right.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on that because I think that, unfortunately, that is what people do when they come here. They're trying to find a way on how to be more American. And in these cases, men and some women as well think that serving for this country and serving for the military is probably as American as it's going to get for them. But unfortunately, that doesn't always end up being the case because it's not given back to them in the way they have committed to the country. They don't receive that same support, if that's the way I could say it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, this is like a really weird topic because I feel like part of me has this, as you expressed earlier, right? Like this weird feeling of like immigrants serving for this country that doesn't really care and value them at all. And so this almost like this question of like why people feel the need to do that. And I think you all touched on some of those reasons. But I think it's definitely like a weird feeling here, because I think if we look at all the bills that have been proposed right in Congress around immigration reform or doing something around immigration, there's always some sort of special path for those who serve in the military. And so I think it's sort of like this idea that in order to be good enough, right, this is a path that you can take where American society will accept you. But it's like, it's a weird feeling for me. And I feel like I've always had more negative associations with the idea of like serving in the military or like being part of the empire per se.
I have a friend who serves in the military and I asked him that question, you know, why are you serving this country when this country doesn't care about you or our communities? And his response to me was that it is the American dream to serve this country for him. That was his response. And as much as we can unpack that, you know, but that's just to state that. So
I think that story makes sense to me though. I mean, I also have loved ones who have served several tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I feel like it's like what I was saying before. It's like their pathway into being American. And I think that when I hear immigrants say the American dream, you know, sure there's this idealistic like sense of like the American dream as this beautiful thing. But when you really break it down and people have a couple beers and they really get real about what they mean by that, they mean like, what's going to give me the light, you know, what's going to give me the American credentials? And that's one way to do it, right? For me, American dream means like, give me back what, you know, America stole so much, like give me some of it back. And what are some ways I can do that? I can serve in the military and get myself an education and citizenship, you know, arguably, or I can do it some, you know, a couple other ways. So the practical side of me is like what your friend is trying to say is like, how else am I supposed to get in?
Right. Yeah.
You know?
But I think it just brings to light the fact that the American dream is a lie. Like, I think regardless of how you're defining it, I think the way that it's been sold, like whether it is a pathway for a better opportunity, like at the end of the day, the American dream is a lie and that people have been sold a lie and bought into it. And I think we need to be critical because I think at the end of the day, even if you're serving in the military for, you know, personal reasons in terms of like trying to advance your own like survival, essentially, you have to remember that you're then complicit in America's foreign policy and everything that the U.S. does abroad, the millions of people that we've killed, that we've invaded, that we've overthrown, like, and I'm like, to be a part of that, I think there's, yeah, it's just like it's a weird.
Although, you know what's weird on top of weird is that, like, for me, like, I'm a Mexican person, right? And I, up until I was 14, I knew nothing else but Mexican politics and culture, and I conceived myself as just, you know, one more of the 130 million Mexicans. And for me, my government is so evil and so intimately a part of the U.S. government, so intimately a helper of the U.S. government, that to me it's like, yeah, the American dream is certainly not something I ascribe to in the way that it's been told to me. But on the other hand, you know, my own, the Mexican dream is also a lie. And so I feel like in our conversations, what's the aspirational part, right? Like if the American dream is a lie, then what is it that we're supposed to be working toward? And I think the mental health question for the conversation today for me is like, okay, I know this shit is a lie, but like, then what's the truth? And that is harder for people to figure out than to call a spade, right? That's the easy part, I think.
But I think it's also about like not depending on nationalism, right? Like I think as immigrants, I think oftentimes for me, I'm like, I feel stateless. I don't feel Mexican or American. So I think it's also about like not needing something to lift up, whether that's a country or anything else. And so I think it's really about like how we as people can like support each other, how we as people can be better, how we can support a community, how we can continue to, get ahead, but not at the expense of other people and not do the exploitation of other folks. So I think that's, to me, what keeps me going, what I feel like is aspirational and is future forward thinking.
I've been spending a lot of time, ironically, even though it's raining bullshit from the federal government, I feel like, ironically, it's pushed me to have to think long term.
Yeah.
And pushed me to have to think like about what it is that I want to build, what it is that we want to build as the alternative to the circus show we call a country. And what is that? What does it look like? What does it take? Can we walk and chew gum in terms of fighting this bullshit and still build something different? And what is that? And I'm looking at Grisanti because she's over there sitting quietly, thinking she's not going to say anything. But
well, we have so many more topics that she might want to chime in on.
I don't want to.
Well,
I was
going to
say
particularly
that.
After the
I know,
and that's okay. Well, yeah. Well, let's move in. We can move into our new topic, which is the labor force. But I just want to say thank you both and for giving us that insight.
It was part of what I was going to ask Grisanti to comment on, because Grisanti has been a star in terms of being
a shining star
in terms of being a member of Centro Binacional, for example, and Frente Oaxaqueño Indígena. And I feel like these are organizations that have modeled for us what it looks like to preserve self-governance, you know, indigenous self-governance. And it's like, isn't that where we should all be looking toward, to build something different?
Well, yes. And I think that that's what I'm hearing Luis say as well, like this futuristic thinking and building our own communities of care and infrastructures.
Yeah, I think that everything you guys spoke about is really important. I think that unfortunately, what comes with immigration is that idea of an American dream that doesn't really exist, as you guys mentioned earlier. And so now, not just for immigrants, but for all of our community, is figuring out where do we go from here? What do we do next with what we've been fed, with the lies we've been told, or with what we're facing, especially now in this country? So I think that you guys all had really important points. There's so much that there is to think about. There's so much that there is to do for the future, but, you know, how do we get to this? Or, at least in my sense, where do we even start?
Okay, so let's move on to the labor force. So, and again, we don't necessarily, in terms of, this is just labor force and the work that immigrants have put into the labor force. If you have anything to say about that, like immediately, we can go there, or I can share.
I guess it's just, I don't mean to take over the conversation, but it just triggers me. Like we, if I want to talk about mental health in my community, I don't want to do it in relation to these institutions that are so destructive, that have totally destroyed our mental health. Like, you know, when we talk about labor force, I don't want to think of myself as an immigrant woman as just part of the labor force to make some fat, rich, white dude more fat and rich and just as white, right? I don't want to think of myself in that way. I want to have a conversation about where we as immigrants, we've proven that we have energy and skills and talent and beauty. And it's like
resiliency.
And we can talk about what we can build beyond being a McDonald's employee or a, you know, a tech worker or whatever. So it's like labor for what? Because we already know we built this country and we give it, you know, we're the ghostwriters of the whole project. So what else can we do? You know, we already know how much we bring. We built everything, and Black people too. You know, we built everything.
Our listeners might not, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, no, I think that that's a good point. And I think oftentimes when we talk about immigration, it is about labor. Like, what are we contributing, right? Mm-hmm. Oftentimes when we look at statistics or there's a video or there's a graphic online, right? It's always like, oh, immigrants pay this much in taxes or they contribute this, right? It's always about like, what are we giving? Because we're always having to try and prove ourselves.
Right.
And that's super annoying.
Yeah. So that's what we're not here to talk about that. We want to talk about like the impacts of all of that on mental health, your own mental health, if you want to share that. That is the conversation, because that's basic. That's the basic knowledge, right? What is the basics? Mm-hmm. Immigrants pay taxes. We know that.
We're just here to work. So.
It's more so to have a critical eye, to have a critical eye around what's happening. How is it impacting our communities?
Yeah, I think this is something that's very important to talk about, especially on the effects that mental health has on all of it. And we can even, directed or connected with our next topic, which was also going to be education. Like, how much of us are we putting into this country, into working, into getting an education for that pursuit of happiness, to move up in the ladder and to get somewhere into that American dream? But how much are we really receiving from all of it? And do we even get what we really want or expected out of this dream?
Well, that to me, like, that's the issue. It's like, how much, it's almost like battered woman syndromes. Like, how much can one person give before it is abuse? I mean, it's to me, it's obvious. Like, the impact that it has for me to, you know, work and give. It's like, it's draining. It makes me forget who I am, or that I am someone beyond someone's employee or someone's mom, you know, or someone's wife. It's draining. I think that's the impact that I see it having, especially on women, on immigrant women.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think our community does have to do that. It's either survive or tackle our emotions. And, you know, it goes both, again, for both women and men. They have these, like, expectations in their roles in our community, and you know, we have a male guest here with us, and there's just so much that is expected from them, so they don't have time to tackle their mental health. They don't have time to stop and deal with whatever emotions they're feeling, because like Dawn Marie said, it's survival. We need to feed our families, we need to feed our children, we need to pay our rent. So how do we deal with these emotions when things need to get done?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's coming up for me in regards to just, like, the labor force is also just this idea, right, that you have to, like, overwork and, like, prove yourself. And a lot of times we deal with our mental health by, like, filling it up with work instead of actually, like, dealing with, like, the mental health issues that are happening, right? So I think as we were having this conversation, something that came to mind was really like my mom, right? How she used to work like 3 to 4 jobs like growing up. And it's not until now that like me and my sister were both like, you know, we both now have like our, what you would call like quote unquote like professional jobs or however people want to call them. And how my brother, he just started at San Francisco State. So now my mom is at a place where she has to really tackle like her mental health, like face to face. So now she's like, she's been diagnosed antidepressants, right? And how now she's really feeling all of like the traumas and the mental health that she went through from when she was in Oaxaca and she had to travel here from like domestic violence. and how now she has to tackle that and do that, like, face to face, like, really face her fears now that she doesn't have really, like, this need to, like, work herself to death as she used to. And now she also has to, like, really also see, like, what are the joys of life as we're bringing, like, other human beings into the world, right? So I'm about to be an aunt. So that's actually, like, something that we're also thinking about. Like, how do we also, like, incorporate things within our family to really, like, shape the future generations the way that we were shaped?
Oh, congrats.
Yes.
Thank you.
On both.
Yanadi's having a baby.
Yeah.
Cute.
Yeah. Congrats on brother's acceptance to some of
yes,
that's amazing.
So cute. I still see him as a little baby. But I'm glad you brought that up in terms of, like, you know, your mom's, your, like, how long it has taken for your mom to have the space to face this stuff. Because I think oftentimes we look at immigrants and we, quite frankly, we're, like, we're really judgmental about, like, why don't immigrants want to see a therapist? Like, why don't you want to deal with your mental health shit? Why do you keep it locked up so tight? And it's like, God damn it, because it's not safe to open up that box. Like, you gotta work. Like, if I do the thing where I go to the therapist and open up that can and fall apart, guess what? I'm gonna get evicted. I'm not gonna have money to pay the rent. I'm gonna fall apart. My kids will be all messed up. And, you know, and it's not, like, economically, it's like you either choose to go down the path of emotional availability and opening up and healing, or you keep this show on the road and make the money and survive, right? And a lot of the times there's an opportunity cost to doing this. It's a luxury to do, like, the formal mental health process and even just the informal, you know, like, healing and trauma-informed whatever. Like, that takes a lot of energy. And when you're doing whatever you can just to put food on the table, that's not even an option until, like, you have a job that pays you well or you are old enough to see your kids off to school and it's like, okay, now I can afford to be trauma-informed and shit. You know, before that, it was just, like, pay that
survival,
rent,
survival,
know, like,
for sure, survival.
You know, and we don't acknowledge that. We just expect people to just do it all, you know? Especially women like your mom, right? Like, mm-hmm. cook, clean, take care of kids, be mentally healthy. Like, shit, pick one.
I mean, I think for me, it's more like generational, because I think what I'm hearing from Grisanti, I think that's resonating for me is, like, I know oftentimes the stories that people want to talk about are, like, DACA folks and dreamers and immigrant youth. But it's like, I think the stories of our parents who I think literally, you know, gave up everything and are probably suffering much more than we are in terms of, like, mental health. And so, like, just thinking about my own parents and then, like, their inability to, like, cope with things. And their inability to, like, deal with the things that they're actually facing, because it's not really an option. Like you said, it's a luxury. And I think it's something that they're just not dealing with. And then you just have to think about the toll that that's taking on their own personal health and well-being, because every day they're working and every day they're having to sacrifice so much. And in the end, like, you know, they may not see the fruits of their labor or whatever the case may be, right, in terms of what they're trying to accomplish, because they're pushing down their dreams or their aspirations or the goals that they're trying to do, because so much of their life is dedicated to their children. So I just want to highlight that.
Yeah, I totally agree. So much of their life is concentrated on us and their children and just even figuring things out here in the States and how things go. And so their dream was the original dream to come here for that better life, but in the end, I do think it's left up to the children to live that better life and take advantage of that opportunity to better the life of them and their families.
And I think this highlights, like, the issue is capitalism, right? Like, at the end of the day, we can do all the therapy that we want, but, like, capitalism is still going to exist. The exploitation of people and working class is still going to exist. And so it's just like, what's, you know, what good is it to feel good for 2 hours that you're talking to a therapist if at the end of the day you're going to go back to a tragic life? That
yeah, it was that just made a light bulb go off in my head. Like, it's, that's so true. Like, for me, the worst, you know, when I was most suicidal in my life was when I first came to this country. I hated the thought of being in this country more than anything. I've never hated anything as much as I hated being here. and the thought of having to come here against my will. And because, you know, I grew up on the border. So for me, the United States, my conception of the United States was drunk Marines, abusive country, ICE, or at that point it was INS agents, you know, abusing young women and children. So like, I didn't have any good ideas about the United States. I thought it was horrible. And I was forced to come here, right? So for me, it was like the only thing that gave me any hope and any like hope at mental health was organizing, right? Was finding other people who were fighting that sickness and who were fighting that fighting for something different that made me feel like, okay, that was the only genuine mental health treatment. That has my entire life, my entire adult life, the only thing that has worked beyond like the individual therapy, which helps somewhat. But the thing that has really helped has been knowing that I'm not alone fighting against that sickness and fighting against these lies, you know, fighting against this false story. And I think that if other people were exposed to this kind of work and that kind of opportunity, it would go a long way for our community's mental health, you know, to know that you're not alone fighting. So I don't know. I'm thinking about your mom right now. I'm sure I'm not the only one.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I think when we think about mental health, I think that to me is why like being political is so important, because again, like, it's not just about like the self-care and the therapy, but it's about like, how can people have like their basic needs met? Mm-hmm. Because I think at that point is when people can have a moment to pause, right? Because they're not working 60 hours, 80 hours a week. They have housing taken care of, right? They have healthcare, they have education, like they have all the things that they need. And when we have that, we can do the pausing, right? Because everything is okay. And so I think part of this idea or conversation about mental health also has to be about like how we become political and how we then ensure that like this is an umbrella, right? That's inclusive of a bunch of issues. It's not just like, oh, how do we give therapy to everyone, or how do we make sure that everyone has like self-care, right? Like, it has to be bigger than that, because it won't be enough.
Yeah, I think that's all really important to think about. And that's what's more important, is how does our community solve these problems and these issues that we're having, that need of survival that doesn't allow us to pause and deal with our emotions and our mental health. So yeah, you guys also just pretty much answered one of our questions, which was, what are the moments that shaped your mental health? And I think you guys all touched a little bit on that. So my next question, or our next question, is ¿cuántos años tuvieron cuando se movieron a los Estados Unidos? And I'd love to hear from our guest speaker that's a little bit quiet, our third guest speaker over there. Can you hear me?
Yeah, so when I first moved to the U.S., I was actually 4, about to turn 5. So I originally got here because first my mom had fled domestic violence from my father. And so then she left us in Oaxaca for 2 years. And so I didn't really have communication with my mom for like 2 years. And that was really when my grandpa, and that's really when they started calling me Moni, which is short for Monita, because I'm cute and stuff. So that was really when I first got to the U.S. After that, I was here undocumented for many, many years. And so we still went through a lot of domestic violence, also with my dad. So after many, many years, we were helping some folks in the Mexican consulate to apply for their U visa. And that's actually when we found out we actually qualified for a U visa. So that's really when we started the process. And I think this year is really important and unique because it has been filled with a lot of emotions. And it's also just like, I think I'm in a phase of my life when I'm really like exploring like my own mental health, my family's mental health. We're also starting a healing collective throughout the Central Valley of healers, like therapists, but also cultural workers as well. Curanderas, like other types of like somatic practices that could also work with folks. So if it all works out, I should technically be accepted, right, in this country in some way or form. So I should be getting my my green card and be returning home for a few weeks, maybe months.
Yeah.
You know, and know what a part of home can be and look like.
I came when I was 4 years old as well, from Colima, Mexico. Similar, or not similar, but like it was definitely a place that like I don't really remember. Like I only got to go back last year after my grandma passed away, but I hadn't been there since about 23 years. My dad came first, and then the rest of us kind of followed after once he found a job here.
So you all kind of touched on a lot of our questions. So we will move.
How about number 8? ¿Enfrentaste discriminación en cualquier momento? Do you guys wish to share a little bit about that with us? Did you face discrimination at any time? Can you share a story of this experience?
Where do we start?
Girl, there's a bear. She's the one.
Well, yes, obviously, remember this is a podcast for our listeners, so they don't know who you are.
Am I not allowed to cuss?
No, you are.
Church-going Mexicans that are going to listen to this. I apologize to you all. I love you. I apologize to you all.
May God bless you all.
Bookies forever.
Yes, los bookies. Yo, that was Saturday morning house cleaning music right there.
I'm more of a Juan Gabriel fan, but
you can have both.
I think it's safe to say we face discrimination.
Right. And just to make you to know, like, so our audiences have said that our podcast is raw. So they appreciate that. So that's to say, like, speak as freely as you want.
Oh, okay. In that case.
Fuck America, fuck the military.
Louise, you're a mixed company. NSA is listening, Louise. I want to live.
They're always listening.
I'll share an anecdote. So when I was learning how to speak and write English when I was in eighth grade, which was hilarious. I can thank Living Single, Jodeci, Tupac for teaching me the proper English. But I remember by the time I got, because my parents in Mexico are somewhat well educated, the intellectual part wasn't hard for me because I already had a head start with my parents, but the language was hard. But, you know, somehow through some hard work and not wanting to disappoint my mom, I made it to GATE and honors classes in high school. And when I was in junior honors AP English class, I had been in that class not paying attention because all we read was like Shakespeare and James Conrad and all this stuff that I couldn't relate to. And so finally, at the end of the year, we were assigned to write about, you know, a multimedia piece about, you know, a culturally relevant multimedia piece about, like, you know, a question that we were interested in, postmodernism, something, I don't even remember. But I wrote a paper about my favorite artist, who at the time was Erykah Badu. And I spoke about, you know, her song lyrics and why I felt like validated as an angry brown woman and all this deep stuff, right? I thought it was cool. And so then I turned in my paper and I was all proud of it. I was so proud of it. I worked on it for overnight. And the only comment the teacher made in front of the whole class was like, this is actually well written. Obviously, you didn't write this. And I was like, well, what do you mean? And I was all embarrassed and my cheeks were all red and everything. I was all sweaty in my armpits. I'm like, what do you mean? And she's like, well, you obviously didn't write this. This is obviously the type of quality writing that you're not capable of doing. So you obviously cheated. So I'm going to give you an F. But this was like in front of the whole class, right? And I was like,
shaming.
So she gave me an F. And so then I went home and I was like, okay, my mom's working. She's tired. I don't want to put one more thing on her plate, but I just couldn't sleep. So I woke up my mom at 3 a.m. and I was like, that bitch gave me an F. I can't deal with it. Why, mom? Why? So my mom was so pissed that she went to the school the next day and she asked to speak to the teacher in front of the class.
Ooh.
In front of the class.
Okay,
and she was
Maria.
Like, I just want to let you know that what you told my daughter is unacceptable. I mean, she lit her ass up. And then she, like, my mom vouched for me, right? She was like, I saw her working on this. And did it ever cross your mind that maybe your class is just not that interesting? And that's why she wasn't engaged in it. And when you gave her something that was relevant to her, she did a good job, right? So that was like one of my first, it wasn't my first discrimination experience or even my strongest, but it's just one that I think other people might relate to who are listening to this podcast in terms of like being so blatantly underestimated. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, just because I don't want to talk about, you know, the Heart of Darkness or Shakespeare don't mean I don't got stuff to say.
Right. Or that you're not competent.
Like if I were to engage you about my ancient history and my ancestors, you'd be blown away. You couldn't handle it. Shakespeare would fall off. Okay? Right.
Wherefore art thou, Shakespeare?
Wherefore art thou? Espérate, cabrón.
¿Alguien más?
Yeah, so I think for me, like, colorism.
Yes. Since
I was born, probably. Has definitely been, like, a big discrimination point. I don't remember when it started. I just remember, like overcooked Mexican really being like something that like I was teased as, whether it be at school. Another obviously like Oaxaquita, right? So it's a very, very derogatory term towards Oaxaqueños because it's kind of puts us as a small miniature less than everybody else. Yeah, and I mean, I think even in our families, right, just like that anti-blackness that definitely like exists. So it was discrimination in the family setting. So a lot of my cousins are actually like really, really light, even though they're also from Oaxaca, but they have more European features. So I think for me, it's always been that. And it's always been like a big part of my life and a lot of unlearning that I've had to do around that. And I think along with that, also like the body image aspect, right? Like what a woman or a young woman like is supposed to look like. So I think in middle school, I also recall just like putting like, I used to put talco like on my hands to like lighten like my skin tone. And so I think about like my future nieces, nephews, as I think about like my future children, I think something I really want to make sure that it's very like real and authentic to them is that like brown skin is beautiful, that dark skin is beautiful, because I feel that that's like the journey that I'm on, where we are all very like beautiful people in our own individual ways.
But also in our like, you have to learn the history of your people to know how beautiful you are too, right? It's mm-hmm. not just like, because I could tell my daughter that she's beautiful and you could do the same, but it's like, how do you really convey how beautiful and powerful we are unless mm-hmm. you really know what we come from?
Right.
You know, and that's not McDonald's.
Right. And I think she spoke to that, as she said, like she had to do a lot of unlearning. And I think we all do, right? The decolonization.
Something else.
But also no shade on people who work for McDonald's either, right? I think there's...
I mean the culture, not the people.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I mean, there was a comment earlier that you made that made me question, because I think you said something else.
Well, I'm also a jerk. So
yeah. Well, just want to correct the record that
right.
there is no shame in any type of
no,
work.
None.
There is value in all.
Get it.
Yeah, I think I was commenting that I agree that there was a lot of things that were happening at school in terms of like microaggressions or like comments other people would make. Always having to prove to white people around you that like you were good enough. But I think for me, I remember the experiences of my parents, right? So like being pulled over by the police, clearly being racially profiled and targeted by them on countless occasions. And so always having like a negative association with the police. And then also from their employers as well. So just thinking about the exploitation, thinking about like anytime there was something that that was wrong that they would bring up, like it wouldn't be actually... they wouldn't listen, right? And so just thinking about how they were discriminated at work, had no rights, didn't know what to do, but like, again, had to go to work and kind of put up with it. And so just always seeing that around me, I think about those instances of experience of discrimination.
Would you mind giving some words of encouragement to other listeners?
Give me some words of encouragement.
How have you lasted this long? How are you still alive?
It's a great question.
We've heard a little
cannabis,
bit.
Red wine, music, good company.
With an asterisk.
Right.
An asterisk. And wonderful friends. That's my answer. All in moderation. All of those things in moderation.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's definitely like family. So family is super crucial, super important to me. So if you don't live with your mom, make some time to visit your mom.
Yes.
I visit my mom, or I try to visit her every morning. I have to wake up super early to do that, but it's definitely a good thing. They really appreciate it. I fill my life with also like my fur babies. Memes help out a lot. beer and wine help out a lot, and also like having really, really supportive soul friendships that mean the world. And sometimes you just meet people and they come into your life and it's a beautiful thing, even if you initially didn't want to talk to them and you ran away from them, but that's okay.
Yeah, I think similar, friends, family, laughter. But I think for me, more than anything, I think it's like a sense of like, what is the alternative? I think that we're lucky to be alive. And so I think we should make the most of it, surround ourselves with good people, try to do good work, and hope that something positive comes from that.
Yeah, like if I could point to one thing, I mean, my jokes aside, right? All of what I said before is true, but like the one thing that at this point in my life, and I'm 36 now, so I feel like a little bit of experience. I think you always gotta have your tribe. Mm. I think you always gotta have your crew that will have your back no matter which way the wind is blowing, even if they have, you know, that like if you get arrested, they can bail your ass out. If you, you know, if you're that, you know how they say, like, if you go after one bean,
you got a whole burrito. That told you yesterday.
Burrito.
That's what we used to say in a
I
Rosie.
Love that.
And like, a Rosie used to say, you mess with one bean,
yeah,
you mess with the whole burrito.
You gotta have that. Like, honestly, I have gone through periods of my life where I didn't have that, and I almost died. And today I can say that the reason why I'm able to put up with this giant crap pile that's going on right now is because I feel like I have my, you know, my chosen family, my tribe. I think, like, number one. That's number one. For me, anyway.
Kelsey, are you here?
Amen. I agree with everything you guys just said. You definitely, it's all about self-care, what makes you happy, your family, having your crew, the people that have your back. All of that is really important. And that leads me to our last question. So our last question is, would you like to give a shout out to anyone who has supported you through all of your obstacles as an immigrant? Por último, les gustaría mandar saludos a alguien que nos están escuchando, que han sido parte de su sistema de apoyo a través de sus experiencias como inmigrantes.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, so it's really like our Central Valley Healing Collective members, particularly like mujeres. Another person is just obviously like my sister, who's been like my second mom. So Yenedith and my mom, Belen, and it's super crucial and important that we name them by name, I feel, so that, you know. And along with that, it would just be like my students who remind me and reground me every day. Otherwise, that needs to continue.
Gracias, Crisanti.
I'm not going to name them, but I think just in general, I think it's like just every undocumented person that I know or that I talk to, and then also all the queer people of color. I think those are the people who give me joy and who I enjoy being around. And so I think anytime I see, even if it's a stranger, I think seeing queer people of color and undocumented people be happy is always really nice and keeps me going. So shout out to you all for continuing despite the struggles.
Right. We're here, we're queer, we're doing things that we need to do.
All right. I'm going to give a shout out for sure to my, first and foremost, my mama, my mothership, because she is my foundation. And she is one of the only people who can keep me humble in this world.
Amen to that, because we need you humble.
I don't know what you meant by that, but I'm going to take it as a compliment.
It is.
And I'd like to give a shout out to my angry brown women, to my tribe of angry brown women, because they really, truly are what allows me to take on problems that are bigger than myself, because I know I'm not by myself. I know I got a whole, you know, got troops. So get your tribe, everybody.
9/11, your troops.
No pun intended.
All right. So I want to thank Luis, Lisanti, and Sabina for giving us your time, your energy, your thoughts, your vibrations. This
beautiful.
This episode is really special for me. I'm here in the Central Valley, my home, with part of the tribe that has, you know, grounded me and keeps me rooted. So thank you all for sharing your energies with us tonight.
I also want to thank you guys. It's been a true honor to have you guys on our show. I'm really excited to virtually meet some of the people that keep Dawn being so awesome.
We're not done yet.
Oh,
we're not done yet. Cheesemate time?
Cheesemate.
Cheesemate.
Sorry,
cheesemate.
My mom's calling. I got to go check my thing.
Cheesemate, cheesemate. Yeah, so Kelsey, you want to tell them a little bit about the chisme del día?
Yeah, so our chisme del día time. And today we're going to talk a little bit of the Kaepernick situation, because it's football season time. And we're going to talk a little bit about the Serena Williams situation and what happened with that. Why don't you get us started, Dawn Marie?
There's a Nike commercial.
So do you want to begin with Serena Williams?
Anyone else want to begin?
Well, let's give them some context.
Yeah, so I don't, maybe one of you can.
I can give the context. Okay, so Serena Williams played in the U.S. Open this past weekend. She played against a Haitian Japanese woman and young woman. And essentially, she was cheated out of the game. A ref called a coaching call that her coach was coaching her while he was in the stands when Serena says that wasn't what was happening. So he took a point away from her, and he also took a game away from her, and he gave them to Osaka is her last name. Pulling up her first name. So what the ump said that she did, so she called him a thief. She demanded an apology, and she says, "You're a thief because you took a point away from me." Well, when she did that, he said that it was verbal abuse. So if we look at the history of tennis, which is usually a white male sport dominated by, you see a lot of men who are extremely disrespectful to referees and umpires, and they're not reprimanded the way Serena was reprimanded. And so that's the context. Naomi Osaka is the woman who was essentially won the U.S. Open.
Oh, so she won? Did she win because of that point?
She won because of the point and the game.
So, I don't know, Miss whatever her name is. I'm sure she's wonderful. I don't know the ref. I'm sure he's a God-fearing man.
He's not.
But even if he were, right? I think that when I as a woman of color saw Serena freaking out on television, knowing not that much about tennis, but knowing how strong she is and knowing that she's kind of a superhero, I thought to myself, this is about more than the point. This is about being called out for being a cheater. Kind of like back to my analogy, like I could relate to my analogy about being called a cheater in high school English class, right? This is about being like the cumulative impact of always being called an imposter and a cheater and a this and a that. And there comes a point where you just can't take it anymore.
Right.
And for me, what was evident is that was one of her moments where she was just like, you know, having that moment of like, I'm gonna flip this table over if you underestimate me and undermine me one more time.
And to that point, she broke her racket, and that's what happened. And so, but in the history of tennis, that's what they do. So I see you over here. Go ahead.
No, yeah, for sure. And I think it's just this idea of like how Black women, how people of color have to conform, right? And there are certain rules that they have to abide, while, you know, white people, white women, like, this is the greatest, one of the greatest athletes, like, of all time. And yet she's still having to prove, right, that she wasn't cheating and that regardless of whether the coach did anything, because I think that's the other thing, right? That call that the coach did, several instances of this have happened in the past, and that rule hasn't actually even been enforced.
Right.
And so it's just like, oh, suddenly now we have rules, right? Mm-hmm. They have that have to be applied. And so definitely it was ridiculous. And then there was like that cartoon that was drawn.
Right.
And so it was just like this constant need, right, again, to prove to the broader, wider society that like you're good enough and you deserve respect, despite the fact that this is someone who's clearly done the work that should be respected and should be admired. And so it's really a shame in terms of what happened.
Agreed.
And dare someone or a woman of color, anyone of color, act out or get angry after being accused, because now we're loud and we're ghetto and we're drama, because we are not allowed to express our emotions or express our frustration against people that are obviously not doing right by us just because of the color of our skin. And so dare us be dramatic, because it is the end of the world.
As Sabina mentioned, right? The stereotype of angry brown woman, angry black woman, and us having to constantly police ourselves when we go into these dominant white spaces. So that's our Chisme de Leon, Serena Williams. And then the Colin Kaepernick, yo, this is hilarious. So not Colin Kaepernick himself is hilarious, but the outcome of Nike supporting him and sponsoring him through his entire protest of the NFL. We saw mainly white people burning their Nike gear to the point where they burned it on their feet,
They deserve that.
And now their feet are amputated.
And isn't that the ultimate illustration of what white people do when they destroy the country?
Right.
No, so Nike's not laughing, because Nike's the next day Nike sales skyrocketed, and what they did just to support the cause, they put out a list of like the 10 safe ways to burn your Nike gear. Make sure you're outside. Make sure they're not on your feet.
You know what that tells me? That we have to take these opportunities. Like we have to be more careful about when we call bullshit and how we call bullshit, right? Because in the case of Nike, like if we were talking about a business like Chick-fil-A, yeah, most of their clientele is probably white. But Nike, when they did a market study, right? They did a market study on Nike's customer base, and they're people of color, right?
Absolutely.
So they know what they're doing, right?
Right.
And it's like everyone knows Nike is powerful, and it's one of the few major companies that whose consumer base is almost entirely people of color, or at least a large chunk. So they could afford to do that, and they should. It's their responsibility.
Agreed. And it was a great move on there. And hopefully Nike...
And it's profitable, obviously.
If you're listening, I think it's time for them to pay their workers a meaningful hourly wage, too. So it's great that you're supporting Colin Kaepernick, but... you know, the workers who are making these shoes also deserve
a little kid
living wage. Right. And the women.
Yeah, I totally agree with you guys. They totally knew what they were doing. Whoever is running their marketing department is doing an amazing job, because they knew exactly who to target and what topics to target. And that brings me to their other commercial that they had. I don't know if any of you have seen it, but it was the commercial where it's a couple... Latina women, all kinds of women, it seems, but it's a lot of brown women. And it starts where like a girl's getting her hair done in the car by her mom, and it's totally like Latino vibes, Spanish radio playing. And then she gets out of the car and she starts running, and then it's a bunch of women like running, obviously promoting their shoes and their Nike shoe running gear. And so that's where that commercial goes. But obviously, they know what they're doing. They know who they're targeting. I don't know if you guys saw it, but if you guys saw it, obviously, they know what they're doing. They know who they're trying to target. And apparently, they're doing a good job at it.
Yeah, I saw it.
You saw it, Luis?
Yeah, I saw it too. But I think I'm like, let's give them credit in terms of like what they're doing. But yeah, let's not forget all the bad things they're doing.
Right.
And then also just like, yeah, like at the end of the day, they did this now because they had just sealed a deal with the NFL, right, for like the next like 10 years or something to provide their uniform. So like, you know, in capitalism, right, these big corporations don't make moves because, you know, it's good. It's good. Yeah, it's good for the people. It's right. Because it's good for their bottom lines.
Exactly. Exactly. So. Yeah. So that it's twofold, right? We gotta.
But I still enjoyed the commercial.
Yeah, I mean, and to the NFL, like they're so much animosity toward Colin Kaepernick, mm-hmm. but now they got a commercial that's gonna play every single time that there's like between the games. They're gonna see Colin Kaepernick regardless if they wanted to or not. So
next step. Let's get a commercial about domestic abuse paid for by the NFL.
Whoa. I mean, that's a whole other thing, right? I'm like, right. The NFL is like a nonprofit. I'm like, please.
Right.
It's like a billion-dollar
industry.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, anything else on Chismes del Día?
Oh, actually, one more thing. I just wanted to send my love out to Mac Miller's family. I thought about this because not only was I a fan, but our next episode will actually be talking about addiction and the struggles within our communities with that. And so I just want to send out my love to everybody who's been affected by his death.
Thank you, Kelsey. I completely forgot about that. Yeah.
And if you're in the path of the hurricane, please get out. Yeah. I hear it's supposed to be pretty bad.
So thank you guys again for joining us. Thanks again to all our listeners for listening. And we will be back again.
Okay.
Thank you, Kelsey.
Bye.
Adios.